Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the next installment of the Boca Raton Synagogue's wonderful program called People of the Book. Each week, we take you through different personalities within our rich tradition, transformational leaders and personalities who contributed to Torah study, to our sacred Torah texts, and to so much more. This evening, we have the privilege of learning together about the great Noda Yehuda, Rabbi Yechezkel Landau. The Noda Yehuda, here's my copy, is a staple in any rabbinic home and any Beis Medrash. His tshuvas, the Noda Yehuda, the name Noda Yehuda, is part of the tapestry of responsa literature when trying to decide any fundamental question in Jewish law. We would be lost without the great Noda, without the great Noda Yehuda. So tonight we'll learn a little bit more about who he was, the life he led, and his legacy that he leaves us, not only his literary legacy, the legacy of the Torah that he leaves us, but also a legacy of leadership well beyond. But let's go back to the very beginning. Let's start again from his beginning, from his start, from his childhood. Where does it begin? The Noda Yehuda lives from 1713 to 1793. He's born in Apta, Poland, and there is a map, a little hard to see if it's small for you, but we see his hometown where he's born. He's the son of Rabbi Yehuda Leib Segal Landau and Rebbetzin Chaya. Note his father's name is Yehuda, hence the title of his book, Noda B'Yehuda. We'll see later in his own words why he chose to name his magnum opus, his responsa literature, in the name of his father. His grandfather was Rabbi Eliezer, the Rav of Dubno. He was an only child, which is fascinating. The Noda B'Yehuda, who was an extraordinary Talmud Chacham, a great leader of the 18th century, and whose legacy continues till today, was in fact an only child. His family was wealthy, was distinguished. He did not grow up in poverty. He did not grow up lacking. He learned with Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac of Ludmir until he was 12 years old, and after that he was autodidactic. He taught himself. Not for now, but so many of the personalities of people of the book who we have seen were in fact autodidactic. They taught themselves. They didn't go to yeshiva. They weren't part of a system. It's not to suggest that we shouldn't have our yeshivas or that we should not register our children or ourselves have regret for having attended. It's not part of the definition of emerging a gadol that you had to have learned or taught yourself. However, it is a fascinating theme or thread that runs through this phenomena of teaching and learning by oneself and not getting lost or distracted as part of a greater system. When he turns 14 years old, Rabbi Yechezkel went to learn in Brody, where he stayed for 4 years. At 18 years old, he decides to pursue a wife. After all, the Mishnah says, Shmonasar l'chuppah. At 18, one should get married. Many matches were suggested. You can imagine this only child was already emerging to be very, very precocious, very brilliant. He came from an illustrious family, very wealthy, very comfortable. And many of the suggestions included large dowries that would have allowed him time to continue to sit and to learn full-time. 1732, Rabbi Yechezkel marries Liba, the daughter of Rav Yaakov of Dubno, a wealthy and charitable Talmud Chacham. So you see, he didn't marry her for her wealth, she didn't marry him for his wealth. They each came from comfortable means, but her father was a Talmud Chacham. And in fact, the Noda Yehuda, Rabbi Yechezkel Landau, fulfills the dictate of our great rabbis who say a person should try to marry a Bas Talmud Chacham. One should search for the daughter of a scholar, the daughter of a righteous person. Parenthetically, I recently saw Rav Yashiv writes that a Bas Talmud Chacham, not everybody marries the daughter of a great rabbi, a great sage, a great scholar. So are they lacking? Are they somehow deficient in some way? So Rav Yashiv writes, Bas Talmud Chacham is a category. The daughter of a Talmud Chacham means someone who's raised by the father and mother, Eshes Chaver Kechaver, in a certain way, in a certain style, and therefore there's certain assumptions about her own priorities, her values, and her lifestyle. So our rabbis tell us, marry a Bas Talmud Chacham, or the category of someone who falls. Rabbi Yechezkel takes it literally, and he marries Liba, the daughter of Rav Yaakov of Dubno, a wealthy and charitable Talmud Chacham. After his wedding, he goes to the father-in-law. Girl wants to live near her family, and in fact, they were taking care, enabling him to continue to learn. So after the chasna, after their wedding, they go to Dubno to be able to study there full time. They were married for close to 60 years, which today is extraordinary, and any time is extraordinary. I recently called someone to wish them a mazel tov on their 71st wedding anniversary, Kein Yirbu. 60 years is a long time in any generation, but particularly back then, in the 18th century, to be married for 60 years, which means that each party had longevity, and that together the couple had happiness and longevity, is nothing short of extraordinary in its own right. Rabbi Yechezkel understood that his Torah accomplishments were only due to her support. And in fact, in his introduction to his Noda Yehuda, this magnum opus of his responsa literature, he writes, quote, "My wife has helped me a great deal. She was willing to tolerate my frequent absence from the house as I devoted myself to learning Torah. He credits his breakthrough. He credits his fame. He credits his scholarship and contribution to her. She was a partner. She was encouraging. She was supportive. And she tolerated his being absent from the home regularly because that's what it took for him to become who he was. After only a short time in Dubna, Rabbi Cheska's father-in-law decided to move back to Brody and asked his daughter and son-in-law to come. And a girl follows her parents. Not always, but in this circumstance she did. And she moved with her parents back to Brody. They agreed. And after returning to the city he had studied in for 4 years as a young man, now in 1734, he's only 20 years old. To just put that in perspective, think about who you were and what you were doing at 20 years old. Think about the 20-year-olds you know today. And just consider that Rabbi Cheska Landau, at 20 years old, was appointed the Av Beis Din, the chief judge, the chief justice of the Brody Rabbinical Court of the Beis Din of this great city. 20 years old. He served in that position for 11 years. And during that time, he rendered very important and significant halachic decisions that made him well known. To be the Av Beis Din means that you're hearing complicated cases, you're adjudicating disputes, but it also means you're answering difficult questions and penning responsa. So even this young man who began at only 20 and serves in this role till 31 years old, he earns a reputation far and wide for how brilliant, for how wise, for how insightful, and for his great scholarship. 1745, Rabbi Cheska and the Beis Din denounced a man for violating Torah values. The man was well connected with the Russian government, who in turn forced Rabbi Cheska to leave Brody. You know, the Pasuk says that you're not allowed to be fearful. And Chazal, our rabbis, Gemara and Sanhedrin, learns from that Pasuk that a person is not allowed to be fearful, that a person should not shy away from hearing or adjudicating a dispute. A rabbi, a scholar, a judge should not refuse or demur from sitting on a Beis Din because they're worried about their well-being, their safety. Kodesh Baruch Hu, the Almighty, wants us to be in that position to pursue justice, to protect it. Tzedek tzedek tirdof. Justice is not only something to be protected, in fact, it flees from us, so much so that we are encouraged and instructed that we have to run after it. So this man was connected with the Russian government, who turned on Rabbi Cheska. When Rabbi Cheska Landau was undeterred by his connections and by his threats, he was forced to leave. They left immediately together with his in-laws. Carriage rode until it came to a town that turned out to be Dubno. And they stayed there for only a few months before an envelope arrived. And the envelope came from the city of Yampol. Now, what is the city? It needed a chief rabbi, and they heard Rabbi Cheskel, this individual who served as the Av Beis Din at only 20 years old, who had earned a great reputation, who left, in fact, not with his tail between his legs. He didn't leave in shame. He didn't leave because he was run out of town. He left, in fact, in a way which was really admirable. He left because he was so scrupulous. He left because he was undeterred to pursue justice, even if a very powerful person was not going to be on the on the favorable ruling. They agreed and recruited him to be their chief rabbi. He agreed. He rose to be the rabbinical leader, Av Beis Din, head of the town's yeshiva, where many students flocked to study with him. Now, I can tell you, as somebody who does their best to be a rabbi today, that one position is difficult enough. One rabbinic position is hard to balance. It's hard to manage. But when you consider for a moment that Rabbi Cheska Landau, served as the Rav, the Av Beis Din, the head of the yeshiva, can only imagine the responsibilities, can only imagine the time constraints, can only imagine the burden, can only imagine the fundraising. He remained in that position for another 10 years, and then another envelope arrived. And Rabbi Yehuda's life can be summarized, the different stages of his life and the places he lived, by the arrival of these envelopes. Imagine if there were email then, how many places he would have moved. Now, where does this envelope arrive from? Well, let's take a step back and talk about the Rabbi Yehuda lives in the 18th century, in the 1700s, but it comes on the heels of the Jewish people being very rocked by the controversy of Shabtai Tzvi. Who is Shabtai Tzvi? Shabtai Tzvi, 1626 to 1676. It takes place after Khmelnytsky slaughtered over 100,000 Jews. The terrible Khmelnytsky persecutions that killed 100,000 Jews. We're not talking about some small figures. We're talking about devastating numbers. And after the Khmelnytsky slaughtered so many Jews, this Turkish rabbi and Kabbalist emerged. And in 1664, Shabtai Tzvi, which was not his name, was proclaimed by Nathan of Gaza as the long-awaited Mashiach. As is often the case with false messiahs, and we could do a whole series tracing and tracking the false messiahs throughout Jewish history, but as is often the case, it's after the aftermath, it's in the shadow of a crisis, of a catastrophe, of a total annihilation of the Jewish people, that the people are desperate. They're desperate for a messenger, a harbinger of hope, of optimism, of faith. They are ripe for the possibility of being taken by a false Messiah. It happened many times before Shabtai Tzvi and happened after. And the case of Shabtai Tzvi was no different. After Chmelnicki slaughtered over 100,000 Jews, then Shabtai Tzvi emerges on the scene and a disciple, Nathan of Gaza, declares him to be the long-awaited Mashiach. 1666, at age 40, he's forced by the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed IV to convert to Islam. And with that, you can imagine, is the end. All these people had followed him. People were confused. People wanted to believe. They jumped on the bandwagon until he was forced to convert. And the one who was supposed to be the Jewish Messiah, who himself converted to Islam, obviously that was the end of the illusion of his serving in that role, but it spurned a series of other false messiahs, again a reflection of the deep desperation of the people who were simply waiting and hopeful, wanting something. We can't even begin to compare what we're going through with this pandemic to the Chmelnicki revolts that slaughtered 100,000 Jews, to the Inquisition, the Crusades, the Holocaust, and the like. But we need to know that the same feelings that many have today of hopelessness and despondency, same depression, the same isolation, same feeling that this is the new normal and it'll never get better. Everyone's just waiting for a message of positivity. Oh, there's a vaccine, hope. Oh, there's a possibility. We've learned something more about the virus. Wait, there might be a light at the end of the tunnel. We can relate again in our own small way because of what globally we are all universally going through. But the Jewish people went through this regularly when they experienced catastrophe and crisis. And afterwards, they were so desperate for some message. And the message wasn't always or wasn't often authentic. And it came across in a false way. It introduced suspicion for centuries that great rabbis were really Sabbateans. That some great rabbis, and this is of course a topic that Professor Schneer Lyman has lectured on extensively, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who has a dissertation on Rabbi Yaakov Emden, has lectured on extensively. But the whole suspicion that even great rabbis whose names we're so familiar with were Sabbateans, were followers of Shabtai Tzvi, that they too were swept up in the movement, was an enormous suspicion. 1725, a group of rabbis in Prague announced that followers of Shabtai Tzvi was long dead. We're already into the next century, but still continuing to feel his influence, that followers of Shabtai Tzvi should be excommunicated. The rabbis were led by the head of Prague's yeshiva, Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz. In 1751, Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz wrote a kamiya, an amulet. An amulet is worn around the neck, is supposed to have medicinal and healing capacity. So Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz and great Kabbalists and mystics and scholars had certain traditions of how to write such a kamiya, such an amulet for sick people. And Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz himself in 1751 wrote such an amulet for a sick woman who was worried about dying in childbirth. There's an example of the amulet on the right. If you're listening online later, there's a PowerPoint. You could find it in the YouTube video. The great Rabbi Yaakov Emden announced the suspicion that Rav Eibschitz himself, the Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, was a follower of Shabtai Tzvi and embedded references to the false Messiah in that amulet. And here we have this collision of two the greatest rabbis of the time. Rav Yaakov Emden, there's not a page of Mishnah Berurah that you turn that doesn't quote the halachic decisions of Rav Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz is a gadol shebegadolim of the German world at the time. And since then, and here we have this collision of the two, Rav Yaakov Emden, a contemporary of Rav Eibschitz, is accusing him of embedding into that amulet messages about Shabtai Tzvi, that he is in fact a Sabbatean, a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. A huge controversy erupts, and rabbis from all over the world weigh in, including such great luminaries as the Pnei Yeshua of Yeshua Falk and others. Again, we've examined in the courses at BRS, and there are phenomenal scholars and scholarship on these topics. But it's fascinating that not only is there a collision between Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden, but that it's able to draw in some of the greatest sages and leaders of the time. So many wrote to one of those great sages, Rabbi Chezkel Landa, who at that time had already earned a reputation, had served as a beis din, a Rosh Hashiva, a Rav. He earned a reputation as a great Talmudic scholar and leader. So in 1754, Rav Yechezkel Landa, the Nodeb Yehuda, who gets drawn into this controversy and drawn into this conflict, pens a letter called Igeres HaShalom. Igeres means a letter, HaShalom, of peace. And his goal, his mission, is to try to reconcile these two great rabbis. The Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden shouldn't be together at war. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, every day, he had a printing press in his basement. And it's been said about him, I think Rabbi J.J. Schachter says about him, how this controversy would have been different, and that historical period would have been different, if Rav Yaakov Emden, every time he wrote something, he had to bring it to a publisher, and he had to convince them that it was worth publishing, that it would in fact sell. He didn't. He had the equivalent today of a copy machine, of a mass printer in his basement, and with every thought, he was able to print it. And things could have been or would have been different if not. So Rav Yecheskel Lando weighs in this controversy, and he writes the following, quote, "Let us gain understanding from the elders and learn from the wise. The sages of the Talmud declared that the book of Kohelet should be part of Tanakh. Both its beginning and its end teach the fear of heaven. Similarly, this Torah genius, Rabbi Ipshitz, is also full of Yirah Shamayim, fear of heaven, from his beginning to his end, from his youth until today. He has toiled to learn Torah without cease. He has acquired the Torah and taught it to others, and as our sages say, a sin cannot come about through a holy person. His tzidkus, his saintliness, his humility, his good deeds are well known. He's helped many people abandon their evil ways. Who else in our generation speaks out against evil as strongly as he? Indeed," he concludes, "the reason the amulet should be put away has to be made clear, so that no one misunderstands it. It should be clear to everyone that Rabbi Ipshitz is not suspected of having any bad intent, and that he is perfectly blameless." So the Noda B'Yehuda, Rabbi Yecheskel Lando, weighs in. He tries to bring together and reconcile these two sides. He says, put the amulet away. Get rid of the kamiya. Let it not be the subject of controversy or suspicion. Let no one accuse it, even falsely, of having Sabbatian references. But on the other hand, how could anyone accuse the great Rabbi Yonasan Ipshitz, Rabbi Yonasan Ipshitz, just like our rabbis debated the book of Koheles, which can so easily be misunderstood and misconstrued. Ultimately, it begins with Yirah Shamayim and ends with a message of fear of heaven, and therefore earns a place in the canon. So to Rabbi Yonasan Ipshitz, who's a tzaddik, who has Yirah Shamayim, he's righteous and has fear of heaven, and therefore he earns a place in the canon of Jewish history, of Torah scholarship, of great Talmidei Chachamim, and it should be without question. Okay, continuing. Prague. Jews had lived in Prague since the very beginning of the city. In the 1300s, again, there was more to talk about Rabbi Yonasan Ipshitz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Shabtai Tzvi. I just wanted to share the Noda B'Yehuda's contribution to that conversation, to that controversy. The next period is related to, associated with the city of Prague. Jews had lived in Prague since the very beginning of the city. In the 1300s, they were confined to a ghetto, which expanded with the Jewish population. In the center of the ghetto was the Altenschul, a great and beautiful building. That's a picture of it on the right. The old new shul, that's the combination of its names. Alta means old, new, obviously new. The Alten new shul, the old new shul was originally built in 1270, and it was restored, renovations were made, and the residents of Prague included great scholars. Prague was in Ir Ve'im B'Yisrael. It was a great city. Position of chief rabbi of Prague was among the most coveted, among the most prestigious in Europe. It had to be filled by somebody who was worthy. It had previously been held by the Shlach HaKadosh, or Yishai HaLevi Horowitz, the Shnei Luchos HaBris, and by the Tosfos Yom Tov, Rav Yovtov Lotman Heller. These were individuals not only for their great works, but known for who they were, their great leadership. So this position as the chief rabbi of Prague, as I said, was an Ir Ve'im B'Yisrael. In 1740, Charles VI died, and his daughter Maria Theresa became Empress of Hungary and Bohemia. In 1744, 4 years later, a pious Catholic gave an order expelling Jews from Prague. A year later, she expanded the decree to expel Jews not only from Prague, but from all of the broader area, Bohemia and Moravia. And the second decree was never carried out, but the expulsion from Prague was enacted. So Jews who had such a long and illustrious history with Prague, a city that was so synonymous with Jewish people and Jewish leadership, became Judenrein, it became free of Jews, as Jews were expelled. 1748, after tremendous bargaining and negotiations, just a short time later, Jews were allowed back to their homes in Prague in exchange for an extraordinary high tax. You know, whatever problems we have, whether you live in Israel, America, if you're living in a democracy which is welcoming Jews to live equal lives, equal rights, the challenges can't be minimized or understated, but how blessed we are to live in such blessed times. When you think back to Prague, 18th century, not that long ago, and so many other cases of expulsions, and Jews were allowed to go back to their own homes, not because there was some sense of regret or remorse, not because of some sense of justice, not because of some cancel culture. Jews were allowed to go back to their homes because they agreed to pay an extraordinary high tax. If the Jews would contribute to the economy by paying an unfair high tax, then they were allowed to come home. So once they came back to Prague, it was time to select a new chief rabbi. And who was there other than Rabbi Yecheskel Lando? One person objected, saying he supported Rabbi Yaakov Emden by demanding that Rabbi Yonasan Abishas put the amulet away. Another person said the exact opposite. What are you talking about? He supported Rabbi Yaakov Emden by putting the amulet away. He supported Rabbi Yonasan Abishas by testifying so boldly about his righteousness. He sided with Rabbi Yonasan Abishas and testified to his innocence, when in fact, maybe Rabbi Yaakov Emden was right. Maybe Rabbi Yonasan Abishas, in fact, was a Sabbatian. And as they debated which side he had taken, they came to realize that, in fact, Igaras HaShalom was a brilliant attempt to not take either side. They realized what too many leaders fail to realize, that their goal is not always to take a side. Sometimes it's to try to bring peace and to bring harmony. It's to be effective, not always to be right. Rabbi Yechezkel Lander, the Node Yehuda, had not tried to take a side or endorse either side. He had simply tried to restore a sense of peace and harmony. And they came to understand that. They decided they were worthy to extend an invitation to Rabbi Yechezkel to leave Yampol. This was the new envelope that had arrived that we alluded to. And with that, he went from Yampol and became the chief rabbi of Prague. And upon accepting it, he was welcomed to Prague. And the way that he was welcomed was with pomp and circumstance. Live music, a band dancing, a big celebration, a big suda. The streets were filled with people who were so excited and eager to rush in a new era of rabbinic leadership and scholarship, celebrating likely not only the arrival of the Node Yehuda, but their own return to a city they had been expelled from, and to restore it to its roots of greatness, of Jewish greatness, with a Jewish great leader. One of Rav Yechezkel's first priorities in Prague was to strengthen the yeshiva there. He spent only half a day functioning as a rabbi, as a rav, and he dedicated the other half to learning and teaching in the yeshiva each day. Halavai. He was able to find that balance, and he served both as Rosh Yeshiva, he had a shir, and the rav of the community of the city. He continued teaching when others took off. The yeshiva met during Chol HaMoed and on fast days and on Fridays. In this way, maybe it's a precursor to the Zilberman yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, which is the only day that it is off, I think, is Tisha B'Av. I think they even have yeshiva on Yom Kippur afternoon. And here, this yeshiva of Prague, of the Node Yehuda, never took off. The Node Yehuda continued to teach, even on days that others considered or called Bein Hazmanim, between the periods of learning, he never took off. He begins many of his letters by stating he doesn't have much time, and he references because he's very busy in the yeshiva. He was very dedicated to his students. Prominent among them, we know, the Chai Adam, Rav Avram Danzig, who is a great-great-grandfather of Rabbi Moskowitz. The Chai Adam, Rav Danzig, lived 1748 to 1820. He was a businessman who ultimately prints this wonderful halachic work, the Chai Adam as well. Chai Adam was a student, was a Talmud of the Node Yehuda. So was the Mata Ephraim, Rav Ephraim Zalman Markolios, who wrote many svarim, notable in halacha, among them the Mata Ephraim. And the Tshuva Me'ava, Rav Elazar and David Fleckless, who lived 1754 to 1826. These are among his prominent students. In one letter he writes, the Node Yehuda, "I received your letter and I recalled your studies in the yeshiva in Yampol, and now I'm happy to hear that you've become a rabbi in a community." He was dedicated to his students. He stayed in touch to his students. He corresponded with his students. In another letter of his we have, he writes, "To tell the truth, I've been very surprised that you haven't written since leaving me. Nevertheless, I asked about you and I heard that you are succeeding in your learning. I'm always delighted to hear that my students have grown and succeeded. That is my delight both in this world and the world to come." Sometimes people don't appreciate. Just today I got a phone call from somebody who consulted me several months ago about a difficult question in his family life, and called me today to follow up and tell me that there was very good news as a follow-up. And I said, thank you. A lot of times, Rabbanim, rabbis, Rosh Yeshiva, Rebbeim, Moras, teachers, we invest ourselves in others, and we're there in difficult times. We don't always know what happens in the end, what the outcome is. So you see, this goes back. This is not a new phenomena. The Node Yehuda, Yechezkel Lander himself, says to his students, "I was so dedicated to you, and you graduated and left the yeshiva. I hadn't heard from you. I'm so eager to know how you're doing and what's doing." 1763, after the Seven-Year War, Jews were financially decimated. In order to not pressure on people, the Node Yehuda created communal takanos. And this is one of the things that he's famous for. Don't try this at home today. But the Node Yehuda, Yechezkel Lander, created these communal takanos. Number one, he limited the amount of money people could spend on celebrations. They should not be too ostentatious. They shouldn't put people in debt. It shouldn't create a sense of competitiveness or shame for the people who can't. Number two, only 10 men can be invited to a bar mitzvah meal besides the boy, his father, the caterer, and out-of-town guests. I assume the mother too. In addition, there can only be 10 men invited. So you'd have a minion, but it shouldn't get too big, too broad. It shouldn't be, again, too large. No musicians or barchanim at the meal. If a person pays less than a certain amount of communal taxes, he may serve only beef, duck, or chicken, but not two of those dishes. So this is a detailed takana. Can you imagine Rabbanim? They've tried it. Takana weddings, takana simchas. hasn't caught on, but imagine that level of detail of what you can serve on the menu. If you are receiving scholarship from school, or you're receiving dues adjustment to shul, or you're not able to pay your fair share in these other institutions, then there was a takana that you were also limited in the type of simcha you could make. No more than 4 musicians at a wedding, the banquet no more than 15 couples, no walking around with expensive clothing, no more small private minyanim at people's houses instead of coming to shul. I like that last takana, not during pandemic times when it's much more complicated, but he was communally driven. There should be a sense of community. And even if there are other localized minyanim, they should be coordinated through community, not private minyanim in people's homes. Back to our friend Maria Teresa. Despite her virulent anti-Semitic measures, Rabbi Cheska wrote a prayer for her recovery from smallpox. She was struck with smallpox in 1767. He delivered a public eulogy, in fact, when she died in 1780, 13 years later, where he extols her virtues and contributions. Did he really admire her? Or was this Mipnei HaShalom? Was this in order diplomacy with local authorities? He praised her political skills as a ruler, and he acknowledged her as a warrior, and described her piety and ascetic lifestyle and philanthropy. He really laid it on thick about her. Again, we have the eulogy that he gave. I'm sure he meant it. A Talmud Chacham would never lie, but I'm sure it was also strategic. And now is a sad story, a sad element of his life. A terrible fire broke out in the small ghetto, and Rabbi Cheskel's home was burned. And you can imagine, in those days, you didn't sit with a keyboard and a computer, an internet connection. You didn't upload it to the cloud and have it backed up in several different ways. It was handwritten. And his writings, which he had labored over, toiled over, his writings, many of them, were lost in that fire in his home in Prague. And he took it as a sign that it was time to publish. So in 1777, his responsa, No de Yehuda, was published on all 4 sections of Shulchan Aruch, including 850 responsa, 850 letters, detailed, complicated, referencing, really comprehensive. He explains in the introduction that he called it No Debi Yehuda, which is an expression that comes from Tehillim, Perek Ayin Vav. And what does No Debi Yehuda means? Known, Noda, well known, Bi Yehuda, because he writes, quote, "The only reason I'm famous is due to the merit of my father, Rabbi Yehuda, who was a great man. When he began, I told you, pay attention to his father's name." And he points out, with great humility and with modesty, that the reputation he has is not earned from himself, but rather with humility, he says, it comes from his father. His response to these tshuvas no debi Yehuda, they spread quickly and broadly. He began receiving letters of rebuttal and agreement, further questions, and he has a correspondence around them. He corresponds with people in the Bohemian lands, in Poland, Germany, Italy. When you are established as a great Talmud Chacham, when people admire and see you as an authority, and they either seek your backing or they disagree with you because they disagree with your conclusion, he's able to have this correspondence. He addresses his response in a very personal way, identifying and mentioning his correspondence often. Sometimes you have some poskim in their tshuvas where they barely reference by name the people who've written to them or any circumstance in which they're living, and you know nothing about their times, their contemporary times. The Nodeb Yehuda is different. He mentions his respondents by name and identifies them. He answers them, and when he asked why he answered ignorant people, he says, quote, "It is my custom to answer whoever writes to me, even the smallest of the small." And that too is another expression of his humility. That whatever the question, it reminds me of Moshe Feinstein. Zatzal had a woman in the Lower East Side in his neighborhood. He used to call him every Friday and ask him what time licht benching, what time is candle lighting for Shabbos. And he didn't say, "Get a calendar, lady. Ask somebody else. What are you asking me?" There was no question that was too small. And that is a very, very important point for everybody, not just for rabbis who answer questions, but to help people learn and realize that there's no question that is too small. 1783, he published the first volume of his Tzlach. So we talked about his No Debi Yehuda, which he began to publish after that fire. And maybe it's his magnum opus, he's most well known by that name. We refer to him, we call him, not Rabbi Cheska, we call him the No Debi Yehuda. But he has other very important works as well. 1783, the Tzlach. Tzlach is an acronym for Tzion Lenefesh Chaya. It's a commentary on the Talmud, and it's based on the Shiurim he used to give in the yeshiva. Remember, he wasn't just a Rav, wasn't just a Posek, but he was not just an Av Beis Din. He was a Rosh Yeshiva, and the Shiurim he gave on Masechtas, he publishes the Tzlach on the volumes of Talmud. In subsequent years, he published further volumes, and after he was too ill, his son Rabbi Yisrael published more. And his other svarim include the Dorosh Latzion, 1827, published posthumously, sermons and homilies, Ahavas Tzion, Dogam Ervava. If you look on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, our edition of the Shulchan Aruch, you have the comments, the gloss on the Shulchan Aruch from the Nodeb Yehuda, from Rabbi Chezkel Landau, known as the Dogo Mervava. While he was a great traditionalist, he was not opposed to certain changes and reforms. On the one hand, he's part of the traditionalist community, and he defended the Mesorah of our people. But on the other hand, he was open. In response to the rule that all children were required to receive a secular education, he helped found a government-supervised Jewish elementary school in Prague in 1782. He didn't outright oppose it categorically, but he rather said Jews should be in charge and control of it, and helped found this government-supervised school. 1788, when Joseph II became the first European ruler to enlist Jews, he supported conscription. He spoke to the first group before they set off. So you see again that even while he was a traditionalist in many respects, in many regards, he also was open-minded in others. And even if he didn't believe necessarily in conscription or in secular education, he was a very visionary leader who understood that better for him to be in charge, better for the Jewish people to have our destiny in our own hands than to leave it to others, which could bring oppression and persecution. What was the relationship between the Nodeb Yehuda and Chassidus? The Baal Shem Tov, Rav Yisrael Baal Shem. The Baal Shem Tov was born 13 years before Rabbi Chezkel, so he's an earlier contemporary, and began a movement that we know swept across Europe. We've spoken in the past, great rivalries about Chassidus versus Misnagdus, the Baal Shem versus the Gro. You can find it online. Rabbi Chezkel, like many other great rabbis, including the Vilna Gaon, opposed Chassidus. And here is a paradox. Here is an enormous irony, which is difficult in many ways to understand. Rabbi Chezkel Landau was opposed to Chassidus. There were others who weren't pro-Chassidus, but they weren't opposed. They were somehow neutral or tried to remain neutral. Among them, maybe Rabbi Kiva Eger, but Rabbi Chezkel Landau was opposed to Chassidus. And yet, Chassidim admired him. Why? For his greatness. Baal Shem Tov described the Nodeb Yehuda, Rabbi Chezkel Landau, as, quote, a new soul. The Alter Rebbe of Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Baal Tanya, said he had no equal in deciding halacha and had never made a mistake in his decisions. The Baal Tanya himself is a halachic authority, the Shulchan Aruch Harav, the Alter Rebbe, but he describes the Nodeb Yehuda as the last word in halacha. Years later, the Divrei Chaim, Reb Chaim of Sanz, writes, quote, if Rav Yechezkel were still alive, I would climb under his table to serve at his feet, because his intentions were for all for the sake of heaven. He was an extraordinarily holy and pious man. So despite his own opposition to Chassidus, Chassidus didn't oppose him. They embraced him, they admired him, they revered him, and they followed him. Now, he issued many rulings disputing Chassidic practices. Again, the Chassidus of today, Rabbi Chezkel Landau, would be proud of. He would be part of. I don't know, be part of, but he'd be proud of. And he would have no problem with. But the early Chassidus, which had some practices and customs, he viewed as needing to push back. For example, two tshuvas. He has a tshuva in Yoredeya, where the Chassidim had introduced a new practice. If we had the time, I'd learn these tshuvas with you inside. They're fascinating. Chassidim introduced a new practice, which was to say the formula L'shem Yichud Kutshu Brichu Shchintei before doing a mitzvah. They found that people were doing mitzvahs mindlessly. They were simply performing them mulamada. They were doing it by rote. So how do you get somebody to center themselves, to focus, to do it mindfully, not mindlessly? By having a meditation, to recite something before you do the act. It centers you, it focuses you, it shuts out distractions, and now you're ready to do the mitzvah. So they introduced this L'shem Yichud Kutshu Brichu Shchintei beforehand, Kabbalistic, mystic, the ability to unite worlds, change the cosmos through this mitzvah, to be focused. And Chassidim do it till today. In a tshuva in Yoredeya, the Nodeb Yehuda writes, he is opposed to it. It's a beautiful tshuva. Why? He says, the idea is lovely. The idea is important. However, we already have a formula. We already have something that we say in order to make us mindful and in order to focus before we do a mitzvah. What is that thing? It's called a bracha. We make a birchas ha-mitzvah. We say a bracha on doing the mitzvah. Then he has another tshuva. Chassidim began the practice of going to visit one's Rebbe for Yontif, even maybe leaving one's family, showing preference or precedence to be with a Rebbe over even one's family. The Nodeb Yehuda has a tshuva in Or HaChaim, where he's opposed to this practice. Why? Because he says, really, there's a mitzvah from the Torah of Aliyah L'Regel. Jews around the world were supposed to ascend to Yerushalayim and to convene together on the Shalosh Regalim, the three festive holidays. Of course, that is no longer binding. It's no longer in effect. Zecher, we do it in a commemorative fashion, but the actual halacha of Aliyah L'Regel, of coming to Yerushalayim without a functioning Beis HaMikdash and Karbanos, is not enforced, it's not in practice. So then the Yehuda writes in that tshuva, he says, if you're going to not go to Yerushalayim, you're not going to go greet and visit the Ribono Shel Olam, but you're going to continue and maintain going to visit and greet your Rebbe, what does that say about Hashem? What does that say about priorities? And therefore he was opposed to that practice. And others. He was very upset and censured Moses Mendelssohn's translation of Chumash into German. He feared it would lead to the study of High German and it would lead to assimilation. And again, he was very prescient and prophetic in that. The Maskilim, in turn, because the Nodeb Yehuda, Rabbi Cheskel Landau, opposed Moses Mendelssohn and opposed the Enlightenment and opposed this progress, what they thought was progress, the Maskilim, in turn, censored his writings and rejected his view and reciprocated right on him. Now, he introduces us to a concept. What's that picture on the upper left? Is a man hunting. The Nodeb Yehuda, and again, I'd love to study this with you if we could, has a tshuva about hunting in Tinyana Yardeya, Simen Yud. And he introduces a category there. It's a fascinating tshuva, not just because of its conclusion. It's a fascinating tshuva because of a concept he really introduces, what we call meta-halacha. Sometimes we have halacha, which is the strict ruling, the strict law, and we have meta-halacha. We have what is the spirit of the law, what is something that is an intangible. You can't point to a specific source, and yet, in a more transcendent kind of way, the meta halacha is something that shouldn't be done. And he develops this in the concept of hunting. Meta halacha speaks to the issue of halachic values, which are independent of halachic law. And he writes, quote, "I am most surprised at the very question he was asked about hunting. Can Jews go hunting halachically?" And he writes a whole tshuva, and he addresses the issues of tzar bali chayim. You're not allowed to make an animal suffer, and you're not allowed to waste things. Is it a waste to kill an animal for no purpose? Are you making the animal suffer for no purpose? Can you justify hunting for sport and for fun, for recreation? To hunt because you need leather, to hunt for the parts is one thing, but for recreation, for entertainment? He concludes that technically speaking, halachically, it's permissible. However, here he invokes the meta-halacha concept, the idea of a halachic value beyond just the halachic law. And he writes, quote, "I'm most surprised at the very question, for the only hunters we find in the Torah are Nimrod and Esav. This is not the way of children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. How can a Jew actively kill an animal while motivated by no need other than enjoying himself in a hunting?" So essentially he writes, technically, it's okay. I can't find a reason to object, to oppose. However, beyond the technical law is the halachic value, the meta halacha, is the spirit of the law. Why would a Jew want to hunt? They would exhibit cruelty for no reason. That's what's entertaining, to kill, to take a life of another living entity, a creation of the Almighty. The only hunters we find in the Torah are people who are evil, who are associated with wickedness, Nimrod and Esav. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are not hunters, they're shepherds. So how could a Jew want to engage in such activity? He has other very famous responsa that he's well known by. His tshuva about autopsies. When are you allowed to do an autopsy? If you would learn something in order to be able to save a life. But he discusses the halachic concept of chola lefaneinu. Are you doing the autopsy because maybe you'll learn something that can maybe save a life in the future? Well, the maybe saving the life in the future, that is not a chola lefaneinu. That sick person is not right before us right now. So how do you define saving a life? Saving a life that's not even yet at risk? Or does it only supersede other halachic concepts and values if you're saving a life that is currently at risk? What about delaying burial? When is it permissible to delay burial? When it will bring greater honor to the deceased? He has a tshuva about offering an oath in a secular court. When a person is asked to swear, to affirm. Jews today, we say, should say they want to affirm. They don't want to swear. There's a famous story of the Get of Cleves, which was a whole episode of somebody who was at times sane and at times insane in the giving of the get, and the controversy surrounding the validity of that get. Shaving on Chol HaMoed. The Nodeb Yehuda is famous, the Tzlach, Rabbi Cheskel Landau, for his opinion about modern-day eggs. Kibetza is one of the shiurim of Chazal. It's one of the shiurim that we learn certain mitzvahs in the Torah require and demand consuming amount of food, kibetza, the size of an egg. So has the size of eggs changed? Has that halachic standard and halachic measurement changed? The Nodeb Yehuda asserts that yes, the eggs today are a different size than they were earlier. And then he has a tshuva, a fascinating tshuva. It's a fascinating tshuva, an Or Chaim, Simen, Lamed Hei. And he discusses the following fascinating case. I remember in Shir, this is what made people's ears perk up. There was people then, in that time, right? We're talking the 18th century and earlier. There wasn't yeshiva dormitories. You didn't stay in the dorm and you didn't eat in the cafeteria. People had what was called teg. You stayed at the home of a host. And if you were lucky, they fed you and invited you to participate in their meal. So he has a tshuva about the following case. There's a young man from out of town who's attending the yeshiva. And he's living at the home of the Rosh Yeshiva. And as it turns out, while the Rosh Yeshiva is in yeshiva giving shir, this young bachur, this young student, is having an inappropriate relationship with the Rebbetzin, with the Rosh Yeshiva's wife. What is the halachic consequence? Must he tell the Rosh Yeshiva? What will that mean for the Rosh Yeshiva's ability to stay with his wife? What should be? How should they react? What are the halachas about palginan diburei and ne'emanas? And who do you tell and how do you tell and what do we know? It's a fascinating tshuva. Now, what about his family? What about his offspring? His daughter Freda married Rabbi Yosef the Tzaddik, a Torah giant. He has a son Yaakov, who lived 1745 to 1822, was a scholar, Talmud Chacham, a wealthy watching merchant in Brody. He has a son Shmuel, 1750 to 1834, the Av Beis Din of Prague. He has a son Yisrael, who was a Hebrew printer and influential in Prague's Haskalah. And he had three more daughters. In fact, in the introduction to at least my volume of the No Debi Yehuda, he has not only the introduction of the author of Rabbi Cheska Landau, which is only one page, which is the Hakdama Samachaber, but he has the Hakdama Miben HaMachaber, the Hakdama of the son of the author, which is many, many pages long, signed by HaKadosh Rav Shmuel Ben Agona Mefursam, Rabbi Cheska Landau, Baal Machaber Sifrei Tzlach, No Debi Yehuda, and so on. So that son, Rav Shmuel, who became the, I guess, heir to the Torah of the No Debi Yehuda, he becomes the Av Beis Din of Prague, writes this long introduction to his No Debi Yehuda. He also had three more daughters. Now his wife of 60 years, Liba, dies in 1790. She had raised their children and supported him in all of his learning and communal leadership. As we saw, he in his own writing credits her with his scholarship, with his breakthrough, with his accomplishments. Rabbi Cheska was broken by her loss. Despite being a brilliant public speaker, he sat silently at her funeral. He couldn't bring himself. He was at a loss for words. This great orator, this great brilliant man, this genius, this author, this halachic posik, this Rosh Yeshiva, this Rav, when his wife, 60 years, 6 decades, his life partner, the love of his life from a young age, 18 years old, when she left this world, he couldn't find the words. 2 weeks after his death, he called everyone to the Beis Medrash. Only then, after 2 weeks, was he able to eulogize. And with a broken spirit, he said, quote, "Because I wasn't worthy, I did not pass away and serve as an atonement for the sins of the generation. But she, my saintly wife, died as an atonement for the sins of the generation and for my sins as well. And now I grieve for this calamity that has struck me in my old age. I feel that what has happened to me is as great as the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. I do not even have the strength to cry for my tragedy." You can hear in his own words how broken he is. 3 years later, when he's 80 years old, Rabbi Cheska became sick. For 2 days he lay in bed unable to speak, but his lips continuously were uttering the vidui and offering the davening, the prayers for the end of life. 17th of Iyar, 5554, 1793, Rabbi Cheska Landau passes away. He's buried on Lag BaOmer. All of Prague, the great city that he was the chief rabbi of, went into mourning. He had been their leader. He was 11 years here and 10 years here, but his real status was Prague, the chief rabbi of Prague, Rosh Yeshiva Av Beis Din, for 38 years, almost 4 decades. He left a will asking that he not be eulogized with the title Tzaddik or Chassid. We've seen several times his humility and how he saw himself. And so in his will, he asked, do not refer to him in the eulogies as a Tzaddik or a Chassid. He asked only a simple gravestone be placed over his grave and that it not be engraved with praise. That is the life, that is the legacy of the No Debi Yehuda. That's his upbringing, his wife, his children, the works. That was his professional career and the trajectory, the different places it took. You saw what his priorities and values were by the takanas that he enacted, that there shouldn't be ostentatiousness, people shouldn't show off, public celebrations have to be done with humility and with modesty. Adapting with the government when it came to secular education or conscription. He is a communal leader. He's an enormous Talmud Chacham. He's an enormous posek. And here are some suggestions for further reading, if you like, articles from which I took this subject. I hope you enjoyed the life and legacy of the No Debi Yehuda, and I hope you're enjoying our people of the book. We hear names, No Debi Yehuda, Tzlach. We've heard these names, Dagomer Vava, all describing the same person, Rabbi Chezkel Landa, but how much do we know about him? We should know them. That's the background of why we started this People of the Book program. Because we hear these names, we throw them around, we reference, we quote, we even share their Divrei Torah. We should know about their life and legacy. Thank you so much for joining tonight. Stay happy, stay healthy, stay holy. If you'd like to continue learning with us, tomorrow morning at 8:15, we'll be having our 10 minutes of meaning here on the YouTube channel at 8:45, Living with Emuna. And tomorrow night, we're going behind the bima with Rabbi Yoel Gold. Until then, everyone have a wonderful evening, and thank you for joining.